accession number 27797, Mr. Maurice Franklin, Real 2. Now, where were you called up? You know, when you got your call up, you passed your medical. Yeah. Where did you have to go to? Where
about a month later, I had, well, I was sent railway tickets to report to a camp in Yeovil, in Somerset. There were two barracks there at this army camp. One was called Houndstone, and one was called Houndstone and Lufton.
What?
Sorry? Lufton. Lufton, Lufton Barracks and Houndstone Barracks. That made up the army camp. Now, I was allocated to go to Houndstone Barracks.
Houndstone. Now, who were you joining there? Was it what unit was it?
There were no units at all at that time. We were just in the army for basic training. 6 weeks basic training it was there for. I was given an army number.
You still remember it, don't you?
Number 11255382.
And you know when you arrived, you arrived basically as a civilian, never served with anything before.
Never.
How did they treat you? You know, you walk through Houndstone Barracks, the gates of Houndstone, you know, you get there. How did they treat you when they first...
I walked through the gates carrying a little attaché case, and as I got off the train at Yeovil, I realised that 3/4 of the passengers on the train were all going to the same place. We were called up together. And let's face it, we were all new recruits. We were all new to it. And we walked in the camp, and we were met by the Sergeant Major, and he allocated us to various huts. And I was in a hut of about 40 people, 20 camp beds on either side of this big Nissen hut it was, about 20 beds on either side. And in that camp was also a little cubicle, which was the Sergeant's own private bedroom, as it were.
In the room, you mean?
In the room. A little cup corner, which is his own private room, the Sergeant's private room, in which he maintained discipline in that particular thing.
Now, and we start. Do you have any heating or anything like that in there? Because it's October, it's starting to get cold.
No, it was freezing cold. It was definitely freezing cold. And I remember that. And also, I also knew that I was the only Jewish boy in the whole of the hut. Didn't know about anything else.
Now, how did you know? I mean, was it just obvious, or were you picked on, is what I'm trying
no,
to
No, not necessarily picked on. I don't know. It's just instinct. I know. I don't know why it is. I know when a person's Jewish and when he's not Jewish. It's just instinct, you know, just like... I knew, because not only that, we were given dog tags, which you have around your neck, which gives your religion, C of E, you know what I mean, Jewish, whatever it was, because there wasn't that many religions as I sat at that time. We weren't such a cosmopolitan community as we are today. And I had mine around my neck, which had Jewish on there, my army number. Apparently, because in case you're killed in battle, they've got your number and your religion, they know how to bury you. That was the purpose of it, you see. And after the 6 weeks training...
Hang on, no, we want to do lots more about the 6 weeks training. Now, what about... how did you get on with the other lads, the other recruits?
Let me explain. This was a unique experience for me because as a boy brought up in London, in the early 1930s and 20s and 30s, I had not travelled anywhere outside London, except perhaps for an occasional day at Southend as a treat sort of thing. So really, I had no knowledge of what was in the big country outside. And when I got to Yeovil, I found out that I was with people from Scotland, Northumberland, Newcastle, areas in which these people had never even seen a Jew. And they didn't even know what a Jew was like. And they were shocked to find that I was a Jew in their hut, because they thought perhaps I had horns on my head, I came from another planet, because they'd never ever met a Jew before. So I was a little bit of an outsider in that respect, because I was an outsider.
So they were a bit nervous of you?
They were nervous of me, and I was equally... No, they accepted me, because they knew we were all in the same boat. And we were all rookies, and we were all trying to keep ourselves out of trouble, if you know what I mean. And we all had our own problems. Plus the fact we were young boys, 18, 19, 20 years of age, who all of us had never left home before. It wasn't just unique with me.
So it was clear that you were different.
Oh, yes.
But, and you were... you were slightly alone in that sense.
Yes, in that respect.
But you weren't badly treated.
No. I can't complain. No. For the fact that they never saw a Jew before, I think I would have been in the same position as they was. I'd have been a bit nervous if I met someone who I hadn't met before. And it was a perfect natural reaction because you don't know who they are, what they're like even. So I can understand it perfectly well. And I was a little bit of an outsider in that respect. But nevertheless, I mucked in. Now, regarding the food situation...
That's just what I was going to ask, yes.
Regarding the food situation, it was difficult for me. Now, during the whole of my war service, I never had any meat in the army. Never. I was a very small eater, so it didn't bother me. I could make do. If I had a piece of bread and butter and a cup of tea, that was all right for me. And I found it very, very difficult. Other people had eat well. I didn't eat extremely well, I must admit, but it didn't matter to me because I could make do.
The vegetables, the bread.
I had a bit of vegetables, bread, whenever it was available. And it wasn't bad in the camp because there you had a mess tin, you were given a uniform, kit bag.
I'll come to that. Hang on, sticking to this kosher. Now, it's not just meat that's kosher, is it? I mean, you have like a kosher bakery, you said.
Yeah.
Were you worried about things?
No,
like
that didn't worry me too much.
It
no,
was only the,
no,
the
because
meat.
That, it was the meat mainly. That was the thing. I thought if I kept off the meat, that my conscience was clear and I was quite happy with that. Okay?
Okay.
Now,
well, tell me about Kitty now. What
now, I was going to say that. When we got to the camp, you see, they didn't have enough equipment to give us because it was very scarce. So one day you'd have a pair of khaki trousers and the following week you might have a blouse and a cap. And eventually by the time the 6 weeks were up, you found yourself with a uniform. Now, for our basic drill, they never had any rifles to give us. So they gave us sticks, sort of carved very roughly into something that looked like a rifle to try and do our drills with, you see. But we'd never even, after 6 weeks, we'd never even seen a rifle yet. We'd never seen an actual weapon itself. Now,
tell me about what training you did. First, let's start with drill.
Right.
Because you can do drill without a rifle.
Yeah.
How did you take to drill? It was the first time you'd been drilled, I'm sure.
We were all the first time. Yeah, isn't it? You know, we'd march up and down. So we learned all the orders and, we had a... I remember we had a very, very tough sergeant. I'll never forget his name. His name was Sergeant Moveley, believe it or not. God knows what's happened to him. I don't know whether he survived. I don't know anything about him, but I left him in Yeovil camp. He was responsible for our training.
Now, tell me the drill. Did you have any problems? Some people got, the penguins, they call them.
Oh, yes, we had some people that couldn't march, and everybody suffered for them because we had to keep doing it again because, and there was all that sort of thing because we had some country yokels, who'd never seen anything at all, never seen the city life before. And they were out of their depths as well because they were in the same position as we were. We were all together in that respect.
Did you understand the point of drill at the time?
Oh, yes, because we had certain lectures as well.
What was it? I mean,
they told us that the drill was done to make sure that we were a disciplined force before we went into action. You know what I mean? And we're not going to go into action as an indisciplined rabble, which is what they said we were, and that was it. But there again, we didn't mind being insulted by the sergeant because we knew it. We didn't care about him anyway. It didn't make any damn difference. But we were all in the same boat together. And because you're all in the same boat together, there's not much animosity because you're suffering like everybody else is suffering.
Now, what
and also remember one point I want to make. A lot of, although there were men, there were no women in our unit at all at that time. There was a lot of homesickness. And many, many men on the first weeks that they were called up cry themselves to sleep at night because they'd never left home before. And there were a lot of people, boys of 18, 19, who were in that position. I was fortunate. I didn't mind. I could muck in anywhere and it didn't bother me a great deal. But not everybody's the same. And some found it very, very tough because homesickness is a terrible situation.
Did you miss your wife and family? Or what? Your family and your new
no,
wife?
I never had any family, no children, no. My wife was home.
I mean your mother or parents.
Yeah, my wife was living with her mother. Because we never had a chance to set up home together. And she lived in the same locality as my parents lived. You know what I mean? So she had not only her own family, but my family as well for support. My wife at that time was very fortunate. She had a job as an as in an insurance company, which is extremely rare, because at that time, very few insurance companies would employ a Jewish person. And she worked for a company called the Ansvar Insurance Company, which was a very, very Christian insurance company, teetotal. They would not take anybody who wasn't teetotal or issue a policy to anybody that wasn't teetotal. It was strictly Christian teetotal company. And she had that job there, and she worked. She had a very good position there eventually. She was the only Jew ever in the company. As I say, that was extremely rare.
So your wife was provided for by herself. And you know,
yes, plus the fact she did get an allowance, I think, of 20, I think when I joined up, she got 25 shillings a week given by the army as a wife, of which I had to contribute out of my wages, I think, something like about 10 shillings of it had to come out of my pocket. So I was 10 shillings short, and the army made up the rest that time. And she worked in the insurance company. Yes.
Now, and let's look at some more of the training. You've talked about drill. What other training were you doing? You were there 6 weeks, so that's till about
November. Well, we were taught how to march up and down, rifle drill, you know, shouldering arms and all this sort of thing.
Did you actually do any weapons training of any sort?
Yes, but not on real weapons, on models, because there wasn't any weapons to give us for training with. Things were very, very tight.
So what sort of thing were you doing with weapons training?
We would see, for instance, they would bring in a gun, something like that, and show us how to use the sights and how to look down the sights and all that sort of thing. And, depending which unit we were going to. We hadn't been given a unit. We didn't know whether we were infantry, artillery, what were we going to go into. It was only after the 6 weeks training.
Hang on a bit, sister. Now, how did... So you did almost no weapons training?
No, virtually nothing.
Any other kind? So, or was it just drill, really?
It was drill, discipline, physical fitness, PT.
I forgot about that. Tell us about the PT training.
Oh, cross-country run.
Were you fit when you got there? And
well, I was a young boy, you know, and I used to like playing football. I was reasonably fit, which I thought, but not as fit as I was when I left the 6 weeks training, I'm going
to
tell you.
So what did they do to you? What physical training did you get?
I went on... We used to do 10-mile route marches, for instance. And that had to be with a pack on your back, your respirator on your chest, still helmet on, your army boots, of course. And that was, we used to do what they call forced marches. That was 100 yards marching. No, 200 yards marching and 100 yards doubling all the way for 10 miles non-stop. And I'll tell you, the first few times we did that, when we got into that barracks, we flopped down and that was it. It was tough. It was tough, you know, they toughened up. And we did get extremely fit, no question about it. Of course, none of us knew to have exercises like that. We never went like they have today, these clubs that do all this sort of thing, where you go fitness club, you never had anything like that. You had to play football as a kid.
Now, what about this sergeant, Sergeant Moveley? How did he treat you? How did you get on with him? What did you think?
He was tough. He was all right. I didn't mind him. I knew his situation. I knew he had to knock us into shape in 6 weeks, and he had to be a bit disciplinarian, or else he'd never get anything done, obviously.
Well, how disciplinarian was he? Was it shouting?
He was tough. Oh, yes. If you did anything wrong, you had what we call jankers. In other words, you were confined to camp. You had to do the latrines out, or do scrubbing the floors and all that sort of thing as a punishment, you know, or come on night duty, on guard duty.
Was he fair?
Looking back in retrospect, I think he was reasonably fair, considering that he had to do that to maintain discipline. I didn't realise it at the time, but now I do, I mean.
And he wasn't anti-Semitic?
No, I never found him anti-Semitic, no. No, he wasn't anti-Semitic, no. He was reasonably good.
Now, anything, you were there about, what, 6 weeks?
6 weeks,
did you go out in the evening at all? I mean, were you allowed out in
after,
the evening?
Yes, I think after about 2 or 3 weeks, we were allowed to go one evening to the local pub.
Did you drink at all?
Very little. I used to drink an occasional glass of beer or shit. That was all, because I'm not a heavy drinker. And I've never seen in my life ever walked into a pub before. for the army. I'd never been to Paris.
How did you find the Yeovil? I presume you went to a pub in Yeovil. What was it like, yes, your first visit?
Well, you see, I was with all the boys anyway, and I had to muck in, whether I liked it or not, and I had to have a drink, because they were having a drink, you follow? And we never had much money. Money was extremely tight. And
were you made welcome in the Yeovil area, in the pubs? I mean, you know, because they're local.
Well, we went with all the other boys in uniform. You all look the same, I'm sure. I blended in with them, you see, because we were all in uniform.
No, but I mean all of you. I mean, because you're all, you're soldiers.
Yeah,
there,
oh, yeah.
Were the soldiers welcome in the Yeovil pubs?
Yes, mate. Yes, not too much. I never found a great deal of it. There was always one or two people who were anti-Semitic. People who...
No, I really, I mean, army. I mean,
in the army, yes, there was always one or two.
I'm talking about, you know, when there's a bunch of young recruits going to the pub, whether you had any trouble because you were army, not because you're Jewish.
No, because they welcomed us in the army. In fact, they would, when we went into anywhere, most of the locals would buy us a drink. Oh, yeah, they were pleased to see us. Oh, yes, the people were friendly here, no problem there, yes. I mean, if you were walking in the streets, if the car was coming, you'd pull up and ask if you wanted a lift. If we ever got on a bus, I mean, even in any time in the wartime, a soldier got on a bus, the conductor never charged us a fare. No, we had a lot of perks by being in the army. In that respect, we were welcomed everywhere we went.
Now, what about I can't think of anything else to ask about Houndstone. You were there about 6 weeks. That would take you into November, late November,
yeah,
possibly.
Yeah.
Now, what was it? When was it decided where you would go? Because you went
at the end of 6 weeks. They got us all together, that tenders, and allocated us.
Now, how did they allocate you?
I don't know. I think it was done by the there was a Sergeant Mowley. Sergeant Mowley was a man. He assessed all the people in his camp, and there was some bigwigs in the camp somewhere, I suppose, who realised whether there was a shortage of men, whether people in the artillery, infantry, or, you know what I mean, and whatever, or Air Force. No, it was all done by... I knew I was going to be in the army because when you get called up, they tell you which branch you're going to be called. They asked you when I went joined up, they asked me which branch of services I wanted to go in. And I wanted to go in the Navy. When I got my called up, I was in the army. So I didn't get my first choice anyway, which was normal. Only those that put in for the army got in the Navy. I never knew anybody that put in for one of the services and got it.
Now, so you.
Anyway.
When did you find out you'd been posted to the artillery then?
After the 6 weeks, they said, right, they posted a list of orders. These are the people who are going into the artillery. I was one of them. And I was going into anti-aircraft, the attack section of the artillery. And
what was your first posting?
My first pool, my God, I can't remember. I was put into a mobile unit because I was in the lights anti-aircraft unit. This is a unit which needs 10 men, right? And a light anti-aircraft gun, which was a Bofors gun. Right?
So this is a light anti-aircraft,
yes.
A battery or...?
Well, it was a battery.
And do you know which number it was?
Yes, first of all, my posting was to the 98th Regiment, 305th Battery of the... light anti-aircraft unit. That's what it was. 305 Regiment.
And you went to them in November?
And we went in November, and we were posted. What happened was, because we couldn't go out in the field as an anti-aircraft unit, because we hadn't any training in that respect, so we were split up amongst other anti-aircraft units there. Two of you went, because there was only 10 men, we were mobile units, so two of us went to this one, two of us went to that one. So we were building up these units. And I was with this one of these units, and we travelled all over the country.
Now, so
because we were a mobile unit.
Where were they when you joined them?
What was the first place? I think I had to go somewhere in... Oh, after the 6 weeks, by the way, we got our first leave, 7 days leave. And we had to report back to a camp in South Wales, I think it was called... No, it was in Cornwall, St Austell, in Cornwall. And I had this pass. I got 7 days leave and then a pass to go report to St Austell in Cornwall. That was the first one, where I met up with my first anti-aircraft unit.
And this was part of 98th Light Anti-Aircraft Regiment, right. But you don't know which part, because you hadn't been assigned to 305 Battery yet.
I know, this was 305. I know it was going to be in 305 Battery.
Now,
see, the battery comprised, I think, of 300, my memory, I'm talking about 6 years, it was, there was a battery comprised of three guns, that's 30 men, three guns in the battery. See, there was A, B, C and D battery in 305 units. And we were one of these gun units, and the unit had a sergeant who was in, who was in charge of the gun, a lance, of course, there was no privates, we were what was known as gunners then, because in the artillery you're gunners, no privates. So it's only the infantry you're the privates, in the army, man. And so there was eight gunners, a lance corporal, and a sergeant. He was in charge, and all the rest were part of the gun. And we had a Bofors gun, which we had a tractor, which we could hitch it onto the tractor, we could drive it around the country. We had a big 10-ton truck in which was kept the ammunition. And then we had another truck for the 10-man crew. So we drove around with two trucks and a tractor which would draw on the gun. And we were sent all over the country, never more than about 4 or 5 weeks in any particular spot.
Now tell us about your training on the Bofors. So well, what was your job on it?
I started off on a Bofors gun. I started off with a ammunition loader to load the guns with ammunition. They taught me, these 10 men, because they were there already. There was only one or two of us new recruits, and we fitted in with the others. That's how we learnt to be on this gun. And
so what was it? How did you load it? Can you remember now?
Oh yes. It used to be, because it was a light anti-aircraft gun, it was, I think it was 45mm shells. They were in clips of five, and you had to fit them into this chute, and they would come straight and automatically feed into the gun. It was automatic, you see. And number four, everybody had a number, one, two, three, four, five. Number one and two, and three and four. We had two men sitting at the side of this gun who had this handle to turn the gun to elevate it or to move it laterally, left or right, see. There was one man on the platform taking these shells, which we were handed to them and put them in this chute because it was automatically loaded. And he had a foot pedal, which when he pressed the pedal, the gun would fire, you see. And because of the noise when a gun fires, they had, the artillery had a lanyard, which is a white rope round the ankle when in the pocket. Now that lanyard used to be fixed to the foot of the man firing the gun. So when the sergeant wanted the gun to stop firing, he'd pull the lanyard and pull his foot off the pedal, because you couldn't shout, because he wouldn't hear you anyway on the noise of the fire. You couldn't shout that loud, you follow? And we went to, and then I went from there to, and eventually I was promoted as I was going along.
Hang on, run ahead. So you were learning each of these jobs, or did you just learn one of them?
No, we used to swing around. I learned all the jobs eventually. We used to strip the gun down, clean it, and all that sort of thing, and grease it, and all that. And we learned as we went along that way, you see.
Now, what maintenance did the Bofors need to keep it
running? Every day.
What was a daily routine?
We used to strip out the breech block, clean it and oil it, clean down the whole gun. General maintenance on that, but we were virtually on our own. We had no one over us, virtually, except the 10 of us. We lived in the field. We'd pitch a tent in the field where we had to live. So we lived under canvas all the time, winter or summer. The food used to come up daily in what we call a hay box. That's a big tin box. And that was your food for the day, whatever was there. And we had to make do what was there. And we travelled all around the country onto our orders. We were told exactly where to go. We were there for, say, 6 weeks or something like that. Then move on to another site. And all were different from, right the way from Land's End to the Orkneys and Shetland Islands, to the East Coast, all over the country we walked. We were taught how to do map reading so we could find our way, because they used to have, the officers in the unit used to come around and visit these sites. We used to have inspections every now and again. We had to have...
Now, how would you set up a gun site? What would it look like? You arrive in...
Well, the first thing, you unhitch the gun from the tractor. We used to put... The gun was secured by four pads, which gave it a level base. and make sure it was firm, because when the gun fires, there's a hell of a recoil, so it's got to be fixed to the ground pretty well. We had spirit levels to make sure the gun was level. Once the gun was set up and ready for action, then we'd see about our tent and our equipment.
And how close to the gun would they be?
Only a matter of a few yards away, near as possible if we could get there. I think it was pouring with rain. And we used to also have, remember, we didn't have any means of heating. We had to light a fire in the field to heat any food we had. Now, none of us was any cooks. And one of them said, right, you'll have to do the cooking. He'd never done cooking in the life. So we had the most terrible food you could possibly think of. Food was, to me, was the biggest curse of all, because no one could cook food. We had some terrible food, we really did, but we had to make the best of it.
Just badly cooked.
Yeah. Well, because, first of all, it was very scarce, the food we had. It was only a hay box with minimum rations, which came every day to us. We never knew what was coming in. We didn't know how to cook the damn things. I never forget, just imagine me as a Jewish boy. I never forget one Christmas morning. I didn't mind being there Christmas. It wasn't a holiday for me in that respect, because not being Jewish, it wasn't a holiday. And we had, we opened the hay box to wonder what was there for Christmas. And they gave us this, it was a pig's head. That was the meat, a pig's head. Now, this is perfectly true. So this chap said, well, I'll try and cook the damn thing. I don't know how to cook this pig's head. I've never seen a damn pig's head before. I knew they had heads, eggs, obviously. But anyway, that was the Christmas dinner that was for. And I think I had a slice of bread, no butter that day, because there wasn't any butter up there, and I think a cup of tea, and that was it. But I was quite, it didn't matter. It wasn't the end of the world. We managed with all that. But that's the sort of thing we had. And it was very difficult. But I'll tell you one thing that they did issue us with. Every man, when he joined up, when we went into Yeovil, first called up, was given a little prayer book. And as a Jew, I was given a Jewish one. I must have it somewhere. It was just basic prayers, you know, to hope that you're going to get out of trouble, that sort of thing, you know, and you're going to come back safe and well, that sort of thing. But it was a prayer book given not only to the Christians had a Christian one, and I got the Jewish one. I remember that. And very, very occasionally, I would see a Jewish padre. Now, this is funny, because I must tell you this now, talking about Jewish padre. I know that. I wonder if this is it.
They can't see it anywhere, Ron.
Look, this is what I was given. Here we are. This is what I went to my headquarters, where we're all on computers. And they looked at the computers, and these were some of the padres, Jewish padres that I saw in my use of the army. Now, here's something there. Here we are. I got promoted eventually to a full sergeant, you see, because there was a lance sergeant and a full sergeant.
Yeah.
But here we are. Dates of promotion, was it? Can't see without my glasses on. Going to 100%. Oh, that's what I went on the detachment commander's course. Occasionally, we would go on a course.
Hang on. You're telling me about the Jewish padre. So, what would they do for you?
They would come and have a chat and say, "Can I help you? Are you all right? Do you have any problems?" You know. But I never had any problems. If I could eventually, if I was anywhere near a town, and I could, he could arrange for me to perhaps go into a synagogue on that day because it was a Jewish holiday of some sort. But I only had that once in all the years I was in the army. I managed to get away for one day. I'll never forget that was one day, but that was the only time it ever happened.
Now, what about, you were moving about the country, but what about going into action? I mean, were you firing at German aircraft? What sort of work were you?
Yeah, well, it depends where you were. Because in some places there was no activity. Other places we were busy. When we were on the southeast coast, for instance, we were busy we started, because the planes were coming in over London, so we used to meet them. We were in Lydding, Kent, was a place we were very, very busy, because that was the air route coming in from the continent over towards London. They used to come into Lydding, Kent. The planes used to follow the River Thames and use the River Thames as a marker for coming into London. You see, that was the thing.